Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and I will host you again tonight as we provide another update on the COVID-19 illness here in our listening area. The first presumptive case of COVID-19 in Louisiana was actually on March 9th. Today, as of April 9th, 2020, there are 18,283 statewide cases, and there have been 702 deaths. Here in Caddo Parish, one of the hardest hit areas in Louisiana, we have 906 confirmed cases, and across the river over in Bossier Parish, they have had 171 cases. Texas has now reported over 10,000 cases, and the numbers in Arkansas have reached just over 1,000. So cases are increasing, but just as doctors and scientists continue to learn more about this novel coronavirus, they are working hard to find the best methods for testing, treating, and preventing this illness. To give us the latest updates on the virus and how doctors are treating it here in Caddo Parish and how a new gas that's used to treat premature babies is being trialed for use here in patients with coronavirus, I am joined in the studio tonight by Dr. Andrew Urochko, Professor of Microbiology, Immunology, and the Carol Feist Chair of Viral Oncology here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Keith Scott, Professor of Pediatrics, Surgery, and Medicine, also here at LSU School of Medicine in Shreveport. Dr. Urochko, thank you for joining us this evening.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Scott, are you with me?
I am.
Thank you, sir, for joining us this evening. So welcome back to Health Matters. Dr. Scott, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about the nitric oxide trial.
Well, this is is a gas, like I said before, it's been used for years and years on premature babies, but we've also used it in pediatrics and adults to treat people with severe lung injury. And we could use it to improve oxygenation. And what we found is in looking at this gas, particularly after the SARS, the first Corona 2 virus, is that people that got nitric oxide seemed to do a little better. And so we partnered with Mass General and UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham, to look and see if we gave this at much higher doses, would it improve lung function? But also we found that at higher doses, it's actually virucidal. It actually somehow not necessarily kills, but at least inhibits the virus to a certain degree, or at least inactivates the virus. And so what we're doing is we have two arms of the trial. One is patients that are on a ventilator. We give it a very, very high dose at continuous, very high dose for 2 days, a little lower dose after that, and we give it until they're better or for up to 2 weeks. And then we have another trial for patients that aren't quite as sick, that they take a 30-minute very high dose of it twice a day. And the hope is that not only does it inactivate the virus, but it also helps improve blood flow to certain parts of the lungs that are actually working best. And that's really the basis of the trial.
Very, very interesting information. How does is nitric oxide something that's normally manufactured and used to help us breathe?
Yeah, we actually make in very, very tiny, tiny amounts nitric oxide naturally. And it's one of the molecules that regulates blood flow through all of our tissues. And we tightly regulate nitric oxide, and because it does have so many effects on the body. What we're doing in this particular case is we're giving it inhaled in very much higher doses so that it does have that virucidal activity along with improving blood flow. And the nice thing about this gas is it only lasts about 30 seconds. It doesn't get into the body itself. It just stays right in the lung. And so there's no toxicity. There's no real side effects to it.
And so when you mention it's virucidal, has that been actually demonstrated in humans, or is that a laboratory finding?
It's mainly a laboratory finding at this juncture.
And I guess, you know, what patients are going to want to know is this something that, you know, let's say you have cold symptoms and you have a sore throat and you're developing a dry cough. Is this the type of indication for nitrous oxide, or do you actually have to be on a ventilator to qualify to receive this treatment, or nitric oxide? Yeah. We'll talk about nitrous oxide in the confusion here in a second,
as
I've already confused the two. But nitric oxide, the substance you're studying, what does the condition of the patient need to be in terms of getting into this trial and getting the therapy?
As I said, there's two arms. Well, it's not two arms, it's actually two different studies. One is for the patient that is severely, severely ill that requires a ventilator. What we do at that point is we normal dose at about maybe 5 to 10 parts per million. In this trial, we're giving it continuously at 80 parts per million, so much, much higher doses. And we do that continuously. Now, for the less sick, say you, like you said, you have, you know, you've been diagnosed with COVID-19 and you have a lot of respiratory symptoms, enough to require you to be hospitalized. And then what we do is come in twice a day with 160 parts per million of nitric oxide, and you take that as an inhaled therapy for about 30 minutes, and we do that every 12 hours. And then what we're doing also is we're testing different blood markers and different types of cytokines and different kinds of markers just to see if it's effective. And we're tremendously encouraged by what we're seeing. But again, we have to test it. We really have to test, like everything we're doing with COVID-19, we really have to test, one, to make sure we're not harming, but the other is to really prove that it's actually helping. And, but we're excited about this gas because not only is it make biologic sense, but it's FDA approved. So if we do find a signal that says that it's helpful, almost every hospital of any size has this ventilator and has this gas in their warehouse or in their respiratory therapy department. And they can start it right away. There's no FDA approval. There's no regulatory delay. They can start it tomorrow.
And in terms of the study design, is this a placebo-controlled trial where you randomize patients to get, therapy that does not have the active drug included?
We don't have that. We're just randomizing the standard of care or this gas. There's a couple of reasons. One is if we tried to randomize blindly, we would have to generate tanks that had oxygen and not nitrogen. Our nitric oxide and hide it from researchers and hide it from the patients. With COVID-19, we don't have time to do that. This is an urgent need, and we have to find out as much as we can, as quick as we can, so that we can address this awful virus.
Understood. And explain to our listeners, if you will, why you can't go to your dentist and get this therapy.
Well, nitrous oxide is very different than, or nitrous oxide is very different than nitric oxide. It's one molecule different. Nitrous oxide, the laughing gas, as we call it, is N2O, and nitric oxide is just NO, so there's one less nitrogen. So it's kind of the difference between water, which is H2O, and hydrogen peroxide, which is H2O. It's just one molecule different, but I don't want to drink hydrogen peroxide. So, they're totally different gases, and they behave in the body differently.
Excellent information. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and you're listening to Red River Radio. This is Health Matters Tonight. We are discussing the recent updates in our diagnosis and treatment of COVID-19, the illness that is caused by the novel coronavirus known as SARS-CoV-2. We have Dr. Andrew Yurochko, your virologist here at LSU Health in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Keith Scott, professor of pediatric surgery and medicine, also here at LSU in Shreveport. Dr. Scott, we're going to get back to the trial as well as get back to therapy, but if I can, I'd like to back up a little bit, Dr. Urochko, and bring you into the discussion. As a virologist, educate us a little bit, if you can, with regards to what's the difference between a virus that causes problems and maybe viruses that don't really cause problems, and what's the unique features of this virus, or what are the unique features of this virus that make it so deadly?
So if you're asking in the context of coronaviruses, this has obviously got quite a lot of news recently. So there, coronaviruses in general as a family infect mammals, not just humans. They're domestic farm animals, many, many animals. Bats have it. Bats seems to be one of the primary species that seems to spread it from animal to animal. Birds also have coronaviruses. So there are many, many coronaviruses in circulating among animals, mammals, birds, and other, as I just mentioned. In the context of humans, there are seven known human coronaviruses. Four of them are benign. They cause a common cold. But all of them, based on studies, have thought to have jumped at one point during our time as humans, from animals to us. One of them goes back to, they guess, obviously these are guesses, to about the 13th century. Others are more modern, 1890s till even the 20th and 21st century. So these have been viruses that seem to have started in animals, been around for a while, and human contact has allowed the virus to jump from animal to human. Including in this are also viruses that have come from domestic animals. So, you know, this is something that just happens over time. In the context of the seven, like I said, four are known as the benign cause of common cold, somewhere between 20% and 30%. Of the common cold, most of them. The other that cause common cold are really rhinoviruses and related species. So we have coronaviruses that are generally benign, they're seasonal. Then we come to the three more deadly coronaviruses, the original coronavirus that caused the SARS, this outbreak occurred from around 2002 to 2003. That was SARS-CoV-1, this is obviously number two. And then the other member is the causative agent of MERS, which still exists, and that's the Middle Eastern respiratory virus, and that's also, again, a coronavirus. The differences are rather subtle, but it's the cell types it infects and the receptor it uses. So the SARS-1 and 2 coronaviruses infect a receptor called ACE2, and the MERS has a different receptor, and it turns out that rather than being sort of the common head cold, these infect through the ACE2 the lungs, and that obviously, as we all know, has a very, very different, unfortunately, a very, very different outcome, and also affects the ability to spread from host to host. And that's seen with MERS, where it's deeper in the lungs, and so it's harder to come out. Unfortunately, it causes a higher mortality, but is more difficult to spread, and that's exactly what's seen where the SARS, both of the viruses seem to have a little easier ability to spread and do have a lower mortality. Luckily, this virus, which is much more easily spread, does have a lower mortality or case fatality rate than the original SARS. So that's a little bit about coronaviruses there. They all infect through the same type of protein on the outside. You've heard a lot in the news talk about the spike protein. That's, and there's been many, many pictures about it. If you want to think of a ball with spikes sticking out, those spikes sticking out are the spike protein, and it's obviously, again, how it got its name. That protein is what binds the cell receptor. Subtle changes in the different coronaviruses allow it to bind to different cells. In the context of the coronaviruses that are causing disease, the SARS number two, so SARS-CoV-2, that particular one binds to the ACE2 receptor, and it does it through, again, the spike protein. I'll stop right there, and I'll let you ask some more questions since I've given us a little history lesson of the viruses.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll remind our listeners that they can ask questions as well. We do have Mr. Wally Derleth minding the phone bank. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Wally will actually text those questions or message me the questions as our phone bank is occupied by our excellent two guests tonight. Yeah, Dr. Urochko, there's a lot that's been discussed about this particular virus in terms of its hardiness. You mentioned, you know, the aspect of it being contagious from the respiratory standpoint, but we hear a lot about people shedding the virus without symptoms. We hear a lot about the virus staying on various surfaces and being able to get it that way. Are there aspects of this virus that you could comment about that reflect some of these phenomena that we're hearing about clinically?
So in the context of some of the common things of coronaviruses, is they are obviously across many different viruses. Some are very, very fragile, and these are a lot of the ones that come out in mucous membrane. Some of the herpes viruses, it has to be spread mucous membrane, so kissing, for example, that, and those are a lot less stable on surfaces over time. Coronaviruses are reasonably stable, and we've known this for a number of years. Obviously, each one is slightly different, but for the most part, they are stable for anywhere from hours to a few days on different surfaces. Things like the noroviruses we hear in cruise ships are very, very stable, and those viruses actually can last in the wild for months. So this one, the coronavirus we're talking about causing COVID-19, has similarity to some of the other coronaviruses in that it is stable from really a few hours to days on various surfaces, and that seems to be one of the common features. What seems to be a little different about this particular coronavirus is this asymptomatic shedder. So it's sort of a real conundrum in the field. Why does somebody get the virus really with no symptoms? We've heard Dr. Fauci talk recently, the director of the Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, that he was shocked that the numbers might be up to, if I remember the most recent interview, up to 50% maybe asymptomatic shedders. We've certainly known since January, maybe even as much as December, that there were asymptomatic shedders. The numbers have become a little clearer. And why you have someone who can get infected and spread it asymptomatically versus someone else who can have very, very severe disease is not entirely clear. Now, we certainly know risk factors, but that doesn't explain all the aspects of that. So I think this is certainly something that seems to be more common in general with this particular coronavirus having these asymptomatic shedders, and that can just walk around with almost no disease. I mean, at least the normal benign coronavirus is you get cold, you get a runny nose, mucous membranes, you sort of know you have a cold. Some are, as we all know, are very mild. We go to work anyway, have a little bit of a head cold, but nothing more. But this one does seem to have some characteristics similar, as I mentioned, to other coronaviruses that infect humans, as well as some features, at least as what we know now, that seem to be unusual to this particular coronavirus. And that's what's made it so difficult. Where SARS, the virus that caused the original SARS and the virus that caused MERS, usually when people became symptomatic, they also started shedding, and that made it much easier to track it. It made it much easier to go into the hospital. You had SARS, you had, you know, the disease that was associated with infection. You knew immediately you were shedding at that point, and they could isolate you, and they didn't have these large numbers of asymptomatic shedders, which make it, as it turned out, to be very, very difficult to, you know, track and find out what's going on with the virus without broad testing. So hopefully that answers the question you just asked right now, and I'll stop and let you ask or any listeners to ask some additional questions.
Yeah, so I mean, it brings up an interesting, you know, question in terms of the virology. If you're going to shed a virus, obviously it has to be reproducing in order to be shed. And so how do viruses reproduce without producing symptoms? And obviously we've heard of this cytokine storm that can be really severe in certain individuals and other individuals becoming super spreaders, right? these shedders without symptoms. In general, is there a virological explanation for how a virus can replicate unbeknownst to the immune system to cause symptoms?
So, you know, those are great questions. So the answer is there's a lot of viruses that certainly replicate and are shed with little or no symptoms. So some of the herpes viruses, for example, the virus that I've studied for many years, cytomegalovirus, is a virus that's shed in breast milk for mother-to-child transmission. There's no evidence of any issues in the mammary glands. There's many of these viruses that are shed through sexual fluids, in kissing, in saliva. Not all of them cause disease. In the context, I know herpes simplex, you sometimes get cold sores, and others are asymptomatic shedders. So in the context of families of viruses, there are certainly viruses that replicate at low levels, get out in body fluids with little or no disease. And that's clearly what this virus must do in those asymptomatic shedders. It must shed at a level in airway epithelial cells in the upper respiratory tract that is not resulting in dramatic damage to the lungs or any of the cells of the upper respiratory tract, yet still are producing significant levels of virus that can be shed in cough, a sneeze, possibly even as much as someone talking to someone. That with this virus, it certainly we need more to understand how it can replicate in an airway epithelial cell and not cause this dramatic disease in that context of, what, like you mentioned, cytokine storm, which might be, which certainly is, a cause of disease in those that come down with serious disease, as does with those in flu. More research needs to be done on that, but like I said, viruses in general, some are very bad. They come in, they cause disease, you know you have disease. Others are very, very good at spreading from host to host. And from that standpoint, a virus that doesn't cause disease is really sort of the ultimate pathogen. It spreads easily, doesn't cause disease, and really uses us as conduits to spread from host to host. And that's not an unusual circumstance in that. And in some cases, disease is really the rarity in that scenario. So it's something that's going to be very interesting to follow up on this this point. And the way I teach when I teach the medical students and graduate students is sort of the virus walks like on a fence. It's very good at walking on a fence. It's a narrow window. If you don't do enough, you don't get the infection. So if you fall one way off the fence, if you go too far the other way, you cause this serious disease. And while it walks the fence, it mediates the immune response, but doesn't do it at any level to cause disease. And that's really what they really, what I'm anthropomorphizing, talking about the virus being a living entity and thinking as if it's conscious or sentient, and I know it does not. But nevertheless, if we think about it that way, its goal evolutionarily is to walk that fence, getting in, causing enough or allowing enough replication without causing disease. So I'll stop there again and let you ask some more questions.
Yeah, brings up a really good question with regards to, you know, public health surveillance. Are the folks who are asymptomatic and actually able to shed the virus, let's say we can do rapid serologic testing to determine who has immunity to the virus, are these people going to show immunity if they've never been symptomatic, or will they need to be tested directly for viral load?
So, again, these are questions that are very interesting and are being answered right now. The way we would note it, if we had testing and that wasn't a limiting feature, and we were able to test, and this is what South Korea, Taiwan, and other countries have certainly done. They've had very rigorous testing. Anyone who has a nasal swab, nasal pharyngeal swab, or any other mechanism by which they might want to test, comes back a positive with PCR, then they will show evidence of the virus. So all those asymptomatic shedders, presumably, if you or anyone else is asymptomatic shedder and we did a nasal pharyngeal swab, presumably we would test positive for the presence of viral genome in that swab. getting to the idea of whether they have immunity, that's a very interesting question, and we don't know how long they shed for. Presumably, those shedders, much like anyone else that would survive a coronavirus infection, at least when we're talking about the coronavirus, this particular coronavirus, they will get at least a temporary immunity. And I know just today or yesterday, Dr. Fauci again suggested that they should at least have immunity through September. And that is going on the fact that these seasonal coronaviruses, you can get them potentially over and over again, and that we do not get the lasting immunity that we've seen and we see with some viruses. So, again, there a lot is unknown. Perhaps this virus will have lasting immunity for at any point going forward. And, again, these are questions we don't know. What we do know is asymptomatic shedders do have the virus. They shed it. In that context, they do. You can find virus in the nasopharyngeal swabs and detect the load, assuming it's over the limit of detection of the swabs and all these kits that and testing facilities like our EVT lab we have set up at LSU. We have a very good limit of detection on par with any lab in the country, really any lab in the world, as far as that limit of detection. And they would be show evidence of that. Presumably, again, as to summarize, they would, or most of them would get show positive for antibodies at some point after that infection. How long that antibody protection lasts at this point is unknown. And again, I'll stop there and let you ask some more questions.
Yeah, so many questions that come up with that as well, especially with regards to a vaccine. And we'll get, we'll get to the subject of what's currently the status of the vaccine development. Dr. Scott, we have a question that was telephoned in. I'll go ahead and let you answer that. And the question is, what should one do when a family member in their household has tested positive for the coronavirus? Should they assume that they've been exposed? Should they be tested, even if they don't have symptoms?
A very good question. And again, as Andrew said, there's a lot of this that we don't know. If you have someone in your household that you've been in close contact with, from our point of view, if you're asymptomatic, we don't know. We don't know if you've been exposed or not. So that's why testing is so important and why we're trying to push testing so much so that we can find out a little more about this. However, if you have someone in your house that has it, I would separate from them. Doesn't mean you need to, move to Montana, but, they can just go to a different bedroom, separate from them until you see if they have symptoms or not. And that's probably the best we can say right now, because we just don't know.
And, with regards, to members of a household, typically people, obviously vary in age, right? And this is a disease that we know affects the elderly disproportionately in terms of the severity of the illness. And as a pediatrician, what's your take on how it is that the younger individuals in general don't seem to get the same level of illness severity as older people or individuals with medical comorbidities?
Yeah, and that's another very interesting thing that I don't know if we'll really understand until this is long past this. But it is very, we've had some few child deaths reported, but they've all kind of been compromised. But the normal healthy child does seem to have this immunity. It may be because they're exposed to it more, so they have this kind of baseline immunity. Maybe their epithelial cells are a little different, and maybe as you mature, they change. A lot of this, I think Andrew alluded to, it's going to be till late fall, winter, as we look back on this and retrospectively look at this, till we actually will be able to answer a lot of these questions, because it's hit us so fast, it's hit us so hard, that trying to do all of this on the fly has been extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, I read something today. Somebody of your stature mentioned they would take an ounce of data about this virus over a ton of opinion in a heartbeat. It's just
absolutely, and that's why we're doing this trial. That's why we're trying to rush these trials so that we can get a little bit of data, because a little bit of data is better than what everyone else is doing. It's just guessing.
And relative to that data collection, and you know, one of the more common topics that we hear with regards to therapy. Now, I know it's not part of your trial, but is the status currently that people who are symptomatic and need hospitalization from COVID-19, are they justified in getting or at least asking for a prescription or dosing of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin? Azithromycin, I suppose.
Yeah. It's a double-edged sword. Does hydroxychloroquine, has it shown some promise in other viral illnesses? It has. Is it the treatment for this? We actually don't know. The problem with everyone, saying, well, what's the harm? Actually, it does have harm. Because particularly when you combine it with erythromycin or azithromycin, there's a thing called a QT interval, which is how your heart, once it fires and it tries to reset the electricity so it fires again, it's very prolonged. And if you take those drugs, it can get so prolonged that it actually will generate an arrhythmia. And you can actually die from that combination. So it's, say it, give it, what is it going to hurt? You have to be careful, and why it has to come from a practitioner that has seen you and knows you. And if you're going to get that combination, you probably do need an EKG at least to rule out that you don't have that phenomenon. But it's less likely to develop that phenomenon.
That also brings up another topic that, I had on the list of things to discuss with you, Dr. Urochko mentions the ACE2 receptor, angiotensin converting enzyme type 2 receptor on the cell membrane of the respiratory epithelial cells. But we know that receptor to be very important in the cardiovascular system, right? And we use ACE inhibitors for hypertension, angiotensin receptor blockers as well. So we know they're important in the cardiovascular system. And it's been reported that potentially some of the people that have the more severe part of the illness get a cardiomyopathy. I don't know if it's direct cardio, myocarditis, or if they have, heart failure with regards to the respiratory illness. How would you pose that with using a drug that has potentially arrhythmogenic potential as well as a drug cocktail?
And that is the crux of the issue, because when it attaches to that ACE2, what we're finding is that patients that do develop the myocarditis, and we're not sure, like you said, if it's direct inflammation of the heart itself, or is it secondary to the lung, or the lung just kind of with the cytokine storm just poisons the heart. But what we're finding is that a lot of these patients develop very lethal arrhythmias, meaning very just deadly heart rhythm. And it's probably because of that ACE2 receptor effect, maybe the potassium magnesium channels, probably a biology I don't understand, but we know that because of that ACE2 receptor, there's a lot of things that happen, and this myocarditis, once it happens, what people are dying from, not only is heart failure, but these refractory arrhythmias, and normal drugs don't work in them. And that's what we're seeing. It's very, very demoralizing when we know we have these great antiarrhythmic drugs and we give them to these patients that have COVID-19 and it does nothing. And so that's why we're so careful about drugs like hydroxychloroquine and erythromycin, azithromycin, because we got to make sure you don't have this other component, because that combination would actually be deadly in you.
And it doesn't sound as though, this is a predictable situation, right? Somebody can show up to an emergency room, have mild COVID-19 symptomatology, be told to go home and self-isolate, right? Come back if you're more short of breath, and then develop, you know, rip-roaring myocarditis and die a sudden cardiac death at home.
Absolutely, and that's, that's a lot of the deaths in New York were reported as these refractory arrhythmias.
All right, let's get to the question bank. The questions are coming in, and I'll remind our listeners, you can ask a question. Wally Derleth is on the phone bank. He's taking questions and messaging me with your questions. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Urochko, we have a question. A senior citizen who's received the pneumonia vaccine, Pneumovax, is asking if that would also cover them for the coronavirus.
In this case, no. The Pneumovax covers obviously a different pathogen in this case, and so unfortunately that vaccine would not work against the infection or the pneumonia caused by infection with this coronavirus.
All right. Great question. Another question with regards to a person who has tested positive for the coronavirus, who is not symptomatic, but they're not around people who have comorbidities, children or senior citizens, should they still social distance? I think the answer is pretty clear on that one, but I'll let you go ahead.
And you certainly want to do that, and the simple reason is if, again, I know I was seronegative when I was tested to be able to go in the EVT lab, but the way I look at it is a virus comes in, and I think I already said this, if the virus comes in and I socially distance myself, don't infect it, when my immune system clears that virus, that lineage of virus is now, quote, dead, in the sense that it's no longer able to spread. If, on the other hand, if I'm an asymptomatic shedder, I go to the grocery store, I go to work, I allow that spread to go from host to host to host. And we don't know at what point it won't find a vulnerable person or somebody with some immune system abnormality or any other effect. Why would a 30-year-old who's perfectly healthy, there was a baseball coach recently in the news about that. And these are really the conundrums. We just don't know what will happen and who will have a more serious outcome with that infection. So as long as you can self-isolate, you have no symptoms, that's fantastic. You won't obviously have any issues, but stay until you the virus, so to speak, is cleared by immune response and you don't have the ability to infect anyone else.
All right, and since you did mention the EVT lab, and one of the questions that comes up is, you know, is the ability for us to actually detect the virus or cases attributing to the increased number of cases that we're seeing in Caddo at the present time, or is this a new infection rate?
So I guess there's a couple questions there. Obviously, the more tests we do, and the greater the ability for us to then come up with an answer of whether the virus is in a person or not in a person. So the EVT lab has expanded the capability of Caddo Parish, Northwest Louisiana, to diagnose patients. So in that context, we certainly have added to the numbers, the 700 the numbers that are, I think, that are up here and the couple hundred that are in Bossier and Caddo Parish. But by detecting alone, we're obviously not seeing the entire picture since we're not testing the general populace. So the numbers are very, very high in this area. And so our tests are simply allowing us to answer questions in the hospital setting. Does a patient have it? You know, does the physician need to be careful with that patient? If we were to screen a nursing home, again, obviously we follow all CDC guidelines and a physician would have to prescribe it. But if we found someone in a nursing home, they had it, can they isolate and protect the rest of them? So, yes, obviously the lab through diagnosis is adding to the number of cases, but the cases are already here. We're just allowing a clinical diagnosis of that particular patient.
You know, and Dr. Or Governor Edwards has alluded to the fact that we may be beginning to flatten the curve in terms of the growth of new cases. Do we think that that's potentially happening in Caddo as well as in South Louisiana? Are we in sync with our southern counterparts?
Well, I think we all want that to be the case, and I believe based on most of the numbers we're seeing in cases, the answer is probably yes, we're getting close to that point. Remember, in the context of flattening the curve, there's two different ideas there. One is keeping the number of people that need to use the hospital system lower than the capacity of the hospital. So, I mean, you certainly know this as well. If you have 100 beds and 99 people are using it, then you're under the capacity of the hospital and everyone can get appropriate care. When you go above that number, you know, then there's issues with the capacity of the hospital and thus the ability to get good care. This is what we've certainly seen in Italy, in New York City. The other aspect is the infection curve of flattening it, in that every pathogen that comes in, there's always a curve with if you think of a curve going left to right, the left part being the upswing of infected cases. At some point, you hit a peak and you flatten that curve, meaning there's no more cases, and then you get to the backside, sort of the right side of the curve, where the number of cases start going down. Now, sadly, deaths lag, as you can imagine, but the curve nevertheless is the same. So I think we are flattening the curve in the context that we're not overburdening our healthcare system, and I think hopefully we're getting close to the peak of the infections supposed to be this week. At least that some of the models suggest that, which would mean that we would then be peaking in the number of cases and ultimately down the line the number of potential deaths that would come from those infections.
Another thing I'd like to bring up is there, you know, even though we have a surge of community-acquired, mostly these are community-acquired, the one thing that kind of keeps a lot of us up at night is the secondary surge. And we're kind of seeing that in a couple of cities, is this kind of spreading to things like nursing homes, rehabilitation. It's kind of been isolated from it, but now we're starting to see this second surge at a different population. It's not the standard out in the public, but these much more high-risk patients that are starting to see. So we might have this double bump. We'll have to see if it happens, but we're very concerned about this second wave that may come on. Even though the curve's flattening, there may be another bump.
No, absolutely, and I think that's really a key point to think about, and this is why this testing that we're doing and certainly others in the region are doing is so important. It's being able to detect, like you said, the expansion of infection and or negative outcomes in rural communities that so far have been a little bit sheltered from that, where we've seen it in the big population centers in this state. And so I think that's a very, very good point. And it's certainly, like you said, it keeps you up. It keeps me up as a virologist. And then, of course, really the second peak, which the fall return of the virus and or whether it goes away in the summer, is another thing that keeps us up at night.
Yeah, and, you know, as the governor has said, the virus is in your community, whether you know it or not. It's, you know, because of the characteristics that we've talked about. And social distancing is just as important if there are very few cases where you are or if there are very many.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, Dr. Rochko, what you've mentioned with regards to some of the genetics of the virus, the question has come up is, do we believe the virus is mutating, and how do you figure out where a virus has come from? We learned this week that the seeding of New York City likely occurred from Europe. How do they figure out, you know, the coronavirus that seeded New York City came from Europe and not China?
So there's a number of questions in that. In the context of a coronavirus, the RNA viruses in general mutate a little bit more quickly than some of the DNA viruses. However, this is a large virus, and it doesn't mutate nearly as quickly as the flu and some of the others. And when they think about where the virus came from, they have some of the original strains that were sequenced, the genetic code of the virus in from China, and they can look for that. So you mentioned Europe, but let me start on the West Coast. So the virus that they thought infected started the infection in Seattle. Because it's so close to the virus from China, that argument would be that particular sort of substrain. These are not the same. These are not differences in broad enough to be a different type of coronavirus. It's all part of the SARS coronavirus 2, but they have some subtle mutations that can be noted, very similar to different fingerprints that humans would have. And so you can look at the virus in the West Coast and see that it was very similar to the virus that was in Seattle, and which in itself is very similar to the virus that came out of China, suggesting it went from China to Washington and then much Washington State and then much of the West Coast. Now, you mentioned New York, so they can take a look at the sequence or the fingerprint of the virus and say, hey, this looks different. Or some of them, the one in New York City did look more similar to the ones from Washington. So there were some people that went from Washington State to New York. But a large number of them, they can look at the fingerprint and say, hey, this looks more like the virus in Europe, which mutated slightly differently than the virus in Washington State. And so they know, based on those sequences and those fingerprints, there might be up to 8 sort of rough different strains of the SARS coronavirus number 2 circulating. And based on those fingerprints, it looked like a large number of them came from China to Europe, and they can again subdivide some of those from where they were in Italy or Germany, et cetera. And so that's exactly right. There's genetic fingerprints that they can use to determine where that virus came from based on subtle changes in the genetic code of that virus.
All right, excellent information. I guess that also leads to, you know, if we have a virus that can mutate, does that have implications for vaccine therapy being more difficult to develop? We hear almost daily, 18 months. It's going to be at least 18 months before we can develop a vaccine for this virus, which is, as you say, very hardy. What are the implications there?
So in the context of the vaccine, I know they're talking 12 to 18 months, and we all hope that will be the case. Certainly I do, as well as I'm sure all the listeners do as well. But that would be the fastest vaccine that would be produced. Most of them take years, 4 or 5 years, some of them up to 10 years for that. So this would be a very fast vaccine. Now, they have done that very quickly, and everyone's keeping their fingers crossed it'll work. To get to your question about the mutations, if the virus were to change quick enough and different enough, that absolutely could affect the vaccine. But luckily so far, this is, as I said, as a larger RNA virus, it doesn't seem to be mutating as fast, and thus there's no pressure because there's so many new hosts to spread. The virus doesn't really have a pressure from us as humans to change much, and this is what happens with the flu. There's a lot of pressure. You've been infected. The immune response is there. It tries to change. You need a new vaccine every year, and that's a very predictable step. So far for this virus, where the vaccine looks like it's directed, at least some of them are, certainly to the spike protein, and they're trying to hit some of the key parts of the spike protein that would interact and would hopefully be more stable. And so that would be at least one of the ideas why they're thinking the current strains that they've sequenced or the genetic code they have, that the vaccine would at least be viable, because it's a region that would be stable. And as I said, this virus doesn't seem to be changing that much to the point where that would affect it. Now, maybe by 6 months from now that might be different, but hopefully that won't be the case.
Great information. Dr. Scott, with regards to treatment, just going back to that category briefly, this week in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, I'm not sure if you are aware of this study or not, but Chen et al. Reported a series of cases where convalescent plasma was given to a small cohort of COVID-19 patients, and they had dramatic results. Are you aware of this paper, this study?
Yes, in fact, brag on us. We've actually been the first in the United States to give convalescent plasma, and we did it on Saturday. And we gave it again on Monday to a particular patient with a very severe COVID-19 pulmonary disease. And we did this with a partnership with LifeShare. And we're fortunate that our community, that LifeShare and LSU Shreveport, had this. We've developed this robust COVID-19 research unit very quickly, where we have 5 or 6 trials, and one of those is the convalescent plasma. And what we did with this particular patient is we took put them on a plasmapheresis, where we took basically much of their plasma off and replaced it with this convalescent plasma. And we're hopeful. We're doing the studies on it, but like I said, we were the first. We're trying to get more and more donors that have been positive and now have antibodies to go donate plasma at LifeShare. Call them, please, if you're one of those people, and they can arrange for you to donate, and we can start expanding this therapy and the trial of therapy over and over.
You know, in this study, if you read it, the serological level for antibody had to be 1 to 640. Do you know if LifeShare is able to actually test the strength of the immunity of the plasma that's donated by people who have recovered?
As far as I know, they do. A different researcher is actually spearheading that. We had a conference call today, and they're expanding that, but as far as I understand, they do have that capability.
And do you have any idea of results yet in terms of how cases that have been treated that way are doing?
Well, like I said, we're the first in the United States to have done it. We've looked at other, like I said, in the Chinese data. It's pretty impressive data, and so we are very one of our many trials that we're doing, it's one of the ones that we're very excited about. Other people have shown that it has promise.
Great information. Well, any other trials going on here? I know there are a number of antivirals that are in development that are in potential trials. Are we studying any of those compounds here as well?
Yes, we have. And just to tell you about the COVID-19 research team, we have about 6 trials now. They range from severe illness like the INO trial and the convalescent plasma. We actually have some where patients are getting better. We start to follow them and, again, follow their immunity, follow their viral load, to kind of see how this virus really plays out over time, because again, we're doing this real time. We don't have retrospection to kind of plan how to do this. We're trying to do this as we go, and we have a huge team right now that's just concentrating on this. We have an inhaled therapy that actually blocks one of the receptors of it, or the novel coronavirus attaches to. We're about to start that trial. We have other antivirals that we're looking at. We have a very, very robust COVID-19 research center right now, and I think the Arklatex would be very proud of that.
Thank you so much for that information. Dr. Urochko, just to wrap things up here, as you're the expert in terms of, you know, what makes this virus tick, you know, summer's just around the corner, and we, you know, we hear the promise of perhaps maybe air density changing, heat becoming an issue, and people are wondering, you know, when can the social distancing restrictions relax? Now that potentially, let's say, we're going to flatten the curve here by the end of April, what do you foresee in terms of you know, this virus being hardy through the summer and when we may be able to relax some of the restrictions?
Obviously, I'm not in the governor's office or at the federal level, but
yes, at least
I'll try to give you some of my ideas. So in the context of the virus, I think everyone is hoping it follows a pattern of the typical seasonal viruses where you have, you know, the flu. A lot of the cold viruses end up being seasonal. They come in our winter. They go to the southern hemisphere during their winter. At this point, it is unknown whether this virus will follow that trend. If you look at Brazil, look at Iran, look at any other country, Australia, that's currently in their more summer area, there are certainly virus cases, as we know. So just being warm and or humid in some cases may or may not necessarily. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is just by getting warm does not necessarily mean this virus will go away the way some of the other viruses do. We certainly hope that. I think when people get outside, they're just naturally farther apart. They're not cooped up in a building. You know, you're not touching all the door handles and things like that. That hopefully will be a good outcome. I think that, you know, like I said, we hope that that's in fact the case, and that summer will be better. I suspect if I saw it today, they're hoping at least for the schools to be closed for the end of the year, to the end of this school year. You know, to me that makes sense. Again, I'm not in power and not in any way advocating for pro or against that. But I think, well, actually I should say, I think it's good that kids stay away until we see this peak goes on the downside. So I think that, to me, at least that's smart. I would not want my kids in school while the virus is still running around. My feeling is by the end of, you know, mid-May, we'll see a lot of these numbers going down, hopefully to near zero, and we'll be able to get back to normal. I think we need to continue to be vigilant. This virus will not be at truly a zero. It will not go away. It will very likely be living in some of these asymptomatic shedders. I think we'll have to continue to be vigilant in nursing homes and in places where, as you mentioned, comorbidities exist. And I think we have to be on the lookout again for fall when people start going back indoors for a potential second wave. And this was exactly what was seen with the 1918 to 1920 pandemic flu, the one we all hear of, the Spanish flu, that there was a real dangerous wave coming back in that fall when people assumed it was going to be over. So I think summer will be better for us. And I think if we're careful, we're, like you said, we're flattening the curve, we'll be on the right side of that curve, numbers will start to drop, and we will be much more able to go out and about. But I think we will still have to continue being careful with this virus, and I'm not sure things necessarily will be completely normal until there's a vaccine or better drugs available for anyone who might be more seriously ill in that context. If you know, in the context of herd immunity we hear about, you really need anywhere between about 70 and 80% of people, and it depends on how easily spread it is. The original was about 70, but percent of people have to be infected to have herd immunity. But with the spread, they're thinking it could be as high as 80%, which tells you we're nowhere near that. So I'm going to be optimistic that summer will bring good tidings for us and the virus start to be go down, but I think we'll have to continue to be vigilant as we go through the summer and into the fall.
Well, Dr. Urosko, thank you so much, and also thanks to Dr. Kevin Scott, both with LSU Health here in Shreveport. In closing, I'd like to encourage all of our listening area to abide by social distancing recommendations, stay-at-home orders, and other regulations issued by your state so we can slow the spread and get back to some form of normal soon. You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. You can also find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on our homepage, redriverradio.org. healthcare.org. I'd also like to send out a very special thank you to all of the healthcare providers in the listening area. You guys really are the front lines defense against this viral pandemic that we are currently facing. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport, Bossier City, 90.7 FM KLSA Alexandria, Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado, Camden, Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin, Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton, Tyler, Kilgore.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. I would have more